As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes and said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which is translated sent. So he went away and washed and came back seeing. Down to verse 24. So a second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." He then answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." So they said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? You do not want to become his disciples too, do you?" They reviled him and said, "You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he is from." The man answered and said to them, "Well, here is an amazing thing, that you do not know where he is from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. Since the beginning of time, it has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born entirely in sins, and are you teaching us?" So they put him out. Jesus heard that they had put him out, and finding him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and he is the one who is talking with you." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, so that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, "We are not blind too, are we?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say, 'We see,' your sin remains." The word of the Lord.
We've been looking at characters in the four Gospels and human beings and others who come into contact with Jesus Christ. And through this person-to-person contact, the people always walk away changed. And he is more and more revealed, so that little by little, through each of these encounters, we see a little bit more of who Jesus Christ really is. And that, of course, has been the goal of the whole series, not just to do character studies, but to learn about the main character through the prisms of these characters. Today we meet some blind men. One is very obviously blind because he's physically blind. The others are not so apparently blind, but they are spiritually blind, and they refuse to see. While the first man goes from blindness to sight, they remain in their blindness. The first man could never for a single moment forget about his need and his blindness, and everything about him revolved around that particular disability in his life, and he was constantly having to face it. For the others, they spent all of their time trying to ignore their need and trying to deny their blindness. And in the end of the story, they are left in their blindness, unforgiven, and in their guilt. The chapter is amazingly crafted as a literary unit. It's one of, I think, three very long narrations in the book of John, along with Samaritan woman and the raising of Lazarus. And this particular chapter, 41 verses, all revolves around the idea of seeing. Seeing, knowing, hearing, perceiving. That's why you find words repeated like light. I am the light of the world. Eyes open, blind, believe, know, judge at the very end. For judgment I have come into the world, meaning for a decision, a verdict to be rendered. All words having to do with the way we see the world. Words that have to do with perception. This whole chapter is about how people see the world and how perceiving Jesus Christ accurately is the key to seeing the world rightly. It's the key to knowing the meaning of life. It's the key to freedom. It's the key to really being fully human. 2 points today, one long point and then one short point. And I say that just to give you hope. One long point, really, and then a kind of conclusion at the end. The long point is seeing the world, how we see the world, and how Jesus sees the world. And the second point is seeing Jesus Christ and what difference that might make in your life. So seeing the world, and the second point, conclusion, seeing Jesus Christ. I've quoted this little adage before, and this week I found it on the interwebs. You know, you can find anything on those interwebs, I'll tell you. And this week I found out who coined this little adage. It's from a news from an article from Vanity Fair, February of 1920. It's almost 100 years old. And this writer says you can actually find a facsimile on the interwebs. I found a facsimile of the very article from which this phrase is taken. You've probably heard it. There are only two kinds of people in the world: people who put people in categories and people who don't. Man, I thought that would get bigger laugh than that. I mean, must be the casual clothes. I don't know. So truth is, everyone puts people in categories. Maybe that's why you didn't laugh, because everybody puts people in categories. And everyone puts situations in categories. Starts off early in life, we feel drops of water coming out of the sky, and we develop a category for it. When drops of water begin to land on your head from the sky, you should get under cover, or you should get under the cover of an umbrella. Problem is, we also miscategorize situations and people. For instance, I'll just use my own ethnicity in this. You may be standing in line at Publix, and you might be hearing a loud commotion behind you, and someone is acting very rudely and obnoxiously, and finally you turn around, and the guy might have a t-shirt that says, "Proud to be Italian." And then you do a little syllogism in your mind. This man is acting rudely. This man is Italian. Therefore, Italians act rudely. And of course, that's how racial stereotypes develop, and that's the source of racial prejudice. We develop categories because we try to make sense of life. And we all know that life is messy, and we will do anything we can to tidy up life, and have categories in our lives helps us to do that. When we tune into this chapter, the disciples are doing that very thing. They see a blind man, and he becomes a case study for them about a category that they have learned and always accepted. And that category is, if you sin, bad stuff will happen to you. And if you sin really big, then really big bad stuff will happen to you, like disability and disasters. And if you do something bad, that thing will come on you. The problem with this guy, though, is that he was born blind before they think he could do anything bad. And so they begin to surmise, how then did the disability come on this man? Was it some sin that he did in the womb? Was it the sin of his parents, which is visited on him? Because that sounds not quite fair, not really a way to resolve the quandary. Or was it perhaps a kind of prepayment on sins that he would commit in the future, which that would be horrible. Imagine that guy going through life. Everyone's expecting at any moment the big sin might come out. And so they wonder. It's all very an interesting theological moral quandary. It's interesting for everybody, of course, except for the blind man. He doesn't think it's interesting. He thinks it's stupid. And when the man is healed, in this delayed healing method that Jesus uses, he spits on the ground. He kind of rubs the spit into clay, and then he puts like a mud mask over the eyes of the man. When he washes the mud away, he's healed. And after the healing, the neighbors jump in. And the neighbors are thinking about categories, trying to fit what happened into one of their preconceived classifications. Is this the blind man? Or is it someone who looks like the blind man? How did this happen? Where is the person who is responsible for this? And then, as is true of similar miracle accounts, the scene is interrupted by the news that this particular miracle took place on a Sabbath day. That's when Jesus Christ made the clay. And now the clergymen get involved. The monitors, as we've seen a couple weeks ago, they step up and they begin to monitor the situation because they too have a way of seeing the world. They have their categories. They have their ways of managing their lives. And they know that the rabbis have always taught that kneading dough on the Sabbath puts you out. And what Jesus is doing, making this clay, looks a lot like kneading dough, and that means Jesus himself is out, that he is not sent from God. And they are really upset about it, and they begin coming after this young man, looking for answers. By the way, isn't it amazing? The whole 41 verses goes by, and nobody ever stops to congratulate the guy. I mean, he's been blind his whole life. He's at least, I think, 14 years old. Probably he is on the younger side, because later they say, look, he's of age, as if they have to clarify that. Probably prepubescent. At least he doesn't have facial hair, so you can't really tell how old he is. But nobody stops to say, man, after 14 years, you can see the world. Let's celebrate together. All they want to do is interrogate him. And so they bring him in, and they interrogate this man reportedly born blind. The whole thing looks very suspicious. Young man, how did this happen? All I know, like the song said, all I know is I was blind. He put mud on my eyes, had me wash the mud away. All I know, I was blind, but now I see. Of course, John Newton took those words into the song we know so well, Amazing Grace. Well, they say, this man must be a bad man, Sabbath breaker. What do you say? Then he responds, it's not really my area of expertise. I've never read a book on theology or any other subject. You read the books on theology. You tell me. But as far as I can tell, I think if push came to shove and I had to give an answer, I think I'd say he's a prophet. Ah, they say. What do you know? Kind of went from Pharisee to pirate on that one. Arr, they say, what do you know? You don't know anything. This is obviously a hoax. Can anyone here even verify that this man was blind? Sir, we actually have the parents in the lobby. Bring them in. It's time to meet the parents. Is this your son? Was he blind? And how did he come to see? And of course, the parents are very cautious in the way they respond because they know how people see the world in categories. Categories for who's in and who's out. And they know that they better be very careful to color in the lines in the way they respond, because if they respond in the wrong way in this particular situation, they themselves might be excluded and might find themselves out. And the parents fear that if they don't answer the questions right, they might be excluded, might be kicked out of the synagogue. So they sort of give up their son. We know he's our son. We know he was born blind. We know he now sees. But when, how, who? You have to ask him. And they're not just saying that to expedite the situation. They're saying that they're giving up their son. John says it twice. They're giving up their son for fear of being excluded. Because they know how things work. The ins and the outs. Fear and suspicion. Inclusion and exclusion. It's the way people see the world. Our categories defined by our own limited perceptions. It's how we see the world. Now, how does Jesus Christ see the world? Well, passage begins, as Jesus was passing by, he saw a man blind from birth. And you know, because we've seen the word to see in an earlier episode where it was very important. You remember Nicodemus came to talk to Jesus, and Nicodemus's opening words in that interview were, "Rabbi, we see that you're a teacher sent from God." It's the same exact word used here. It's a word that means to see or to know. You know, if someone is explaining something to you and they say, "You get it?" And then you say, "I see." You don't really mean "I see." You mean "I perceive." "I understand." You see what I mean? Good, I know you did. And so that's the word that's used here 10 times in this episode. Jesus Christ sees. But he doesn't just see, he perceives, he knows. He sees people. He sees into people. And we've seen that earlier in the book of John too. He knows what is in a man. And he perceives people. He doesn't gawk at people as if they're curiosities like the neighbors did. He doesn't file people into neat and interesting ethical classifications like the disciples did, who wonder who sinned, he or his parents. He doesn't turn people into ethical case studies. Nor is Jesus going to use the commands of God as categorical restraints that would excuse him or prevent him from showing compassion or showing help to the man, as if Jesus could say, "Sorry, dude, Sabbath, nothing I can do to help you today. Can't do any work." No, Jesus Christ knows. The Sabbath was made for man. The Sabbath was made to relieve the burden of having to work 24/7. And it commands a day where we rest. The Sabbath is an act of mercy from God to take the burden off of us. And when Jesus takes the burden off this man, he thinks, well, this is perfectly in keeping with the intention of the Sabbath, to take burdens off of people. Nor is Jesus at all afraid of being judged by people or himself being excluded and categorized. Instead, Jesus sees. He perceives people. He looks past what you or I could see on the surface appearance of people. He understands. We saw the pattern. I urge you to look it up in the four Gospels this week, or do a study on it sometime. How Jesus approaches people. He sees them. He moves toward them, he feels for them, and then he helps them, he heals them. He gives himself to this man. I mean, gives his own stuff. He gives spit. And I know you think, well, that's kind of weird in our germophobic culture that Jesus would use spit in this healing. But let me remind you, Jesus Christ doesn't really care about our categories for hygiene and etiquette. Man is taken from the dust, you remember? Genesis 1 and 2. And Jesus turns the dust into life for the man. Uses it to make the man whole. Jesus was sent from God. It's a very important word, sent. And he sends the man to a pool called the Pool of Siloam, which translated means sent. Over 20 times in the gospel according to John, Jesus is referred to by that particular word, one sent from the Father. And that's how Jesus sees the world. He sees the world as a mission field into which he has been sent. Sent to heal, sent to find, sent to save. And later, when this man is indeed excluded and he is put out of the temple and the synagogue, he's put out of the in-group, Jesus Christ goes and finds, that's the word, finds the outcast like the good shepherd. Chapter 10 is the good shepherd discourse. So before we get to that chapter, he's showing us what a good shepherd looks like. He finds the excluded and he brings them in. He engages with this lost sheep. All right, so let's recap. TJ, let me get this clear what you're saying here. The way we see the world is narrow and exclusionary and categorized, and we put people out, we make our classifications. And what you're saying, TJ, if I get you right, is Jesus Christ is not like that. He is open and he is inclusive and he doesn't have any categories, right? Yes and no. He is different by our standards. He's loving, he's perceptive, he's self-giving, he's courageous in a way that we're not, but he's not sentimental. He's not mindless. He's not nice. You can quote me on that. Jesus Christ is not nice. He's kind, but there's a great difference between kindness and niceness. And Jesus is not nice. He's not a tame lion. Not inclusive in the way of our own culture's modern hyper-tolerance, that live and let live, which I said last week, tolerance is not the same as love. He is the unavoidable issue. He is the watershed. He is the great dividing line. He has categories too. But unlike our categories, his perception is not limited. And he sees the real issues in people's lives. Issues that are huge, like light and darkness, death and life, seeing and blindness. At the very end of the scene, when he sees the man now healed and excluded from the temple, Jesus Christ again finds the man and he approaches the man. And he births the man, like a midwife. He births him into life, from unbelief to faith. And then Jesus Christ says to the man, for judgment, I have come into the world. In other words, my coming to planet Earth is the verdict pronounced on planet Earth. You know, the book of John is organized like a legal case. And I mentioned to someone before the service, Richard Balcom, and the great book, which I highly recommend, called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. It's about 8 years old now, Oxford Press. Get that book. It's fantastic. He looks at the Gospel of John like a legal case, and he focuses in on the importance of the eyewitnesses. And as you read the book of John, ostensibly the one on trial is Jesus Christ. But at a deeper level, the real one on trial is the world. For judgment, says Jesus, I have come into the world. My coming is the rendering of a verdict. My coming has now created two totally new categories. Apart from me, there is nothing but darkness and guilt. In me, there is light and life. The verdict of my coming says, if the world could save itself, if the world could reform or fix itself, I would not have to come and live and die in the place of the guilty and broken. But my coming, my arrival on enemy soil, my landing on planet Earth is the verdict. It's the decision that the world stands condemned and estranged from my Father. And my coming is the great verdict, the great expose. The world cannot be fixed unless I come and live as a new man, a representative of a new human race, a second Adam, the only one truly obedient man. And then when I've lived perfect obedience to love and to the law of God, after I've lived that way, I will face the judgment and I will die under the sentence that belongs to the guilty. This is how Jesus Christ sees the world. It's as Warren Gage taught us when he was with us in a seminar, that the miracles all say something about what Jesus Christ is come to do. What does spit and earth, what does that say about what Jesus has come to do? Well, remember, Jesus is saying, unless I be showered with human spit, you cannot be healed. Unless I go into the earth and be blindfolded, you will never be able to see. The earth was cursed, remember? In Genesis chapter 3. And Jesus goes into the earth in order to reclaim the earth, to rescue it from the curse. And his making earth here is an emblem of that whole thing. This is the verdict, says Jesus. From now on, everyone is either in Adam or in me, represented by the fallen man or by the one obedient man. From now on, there are only two categories. Everyone is in me or in Adam, on one side or the other. All the other categories are fairly meaningless in comparison with this. Now you might say, I like the story, TJ, but do you really want to draw that conclusion for these people, sophisticated 21st century South Floridian people? I mean, do you really want to say there's only two categories? Really want to say that everyone represented by Jesus is accepted by God and everyone represented by Adam is not accepted by God? Do you really want to make things in this day and age, this pluralistic society, this coexist world that we live in, do you really want to be so narrow? We see, we're all narrow. We all have our own categories by which we define who's in and who's out. We all divide the world up into categories. Good people and bad people. Educated and ignorant. Liberal and conservative. Old and young. Rich and poor. Normal people and unusual people. People born here. People who have immigrated here. Cool and uncool. Attractive and plain, in shape and out of shape, Jew and Gentile, North and South. We're all narrow-minded. But you see, none of these categories really matters to Jesus Christ. And in that sense, he's wildly inclusive. He's redefined all the categories. For Jesus, though, there's now only one watershed issue. One verdict for judgment, the pronunciation of a verdict. I have come into the world. Be in any of these categories that I just mentioned without Jesus, and you're lost. Be in any of the categories with Jesus, and you're found. In that sense, he is fantastically exclusive. Inclusion and exclusion redefined. That's how Jesus sees the world. Seeing the world, how do we see it, and how does Jesus see it? And now for the conclusion, seeing Jesus. How do we come to see Jesus for who he is, and what happens when we do? Well, the clergymen were so convinced that they knew, that they saw, they perceived the world the way it really is. And that's what keeps them from really seeing. You know the great impediment to their seeing the world? Is their own self-confidence. Their own self-confidence is so big, they can't see around it. It's all they can see. But Jesus Christ is saying to them, and Jesus Christ is saying to us, if you'd only come out with your hands up. And just admit. Say the three words. I don't know. Just say the words. I don't see. If you just say those words, then I could give you sight. But because you insist on proving that you do know, that you do see, I can be of no help to you, and your sin remains. And what he's saying is, either in the end of time, either I will be your attorney or I will be your judge. Your sin will either be forgiven as I represent you in court on the final day, or your sin will be condemned. It's not sin, really, that keeps you out of my kingdom. It's the insistence that you don't need grace. Insisting that you're right. That you know. That you see. You know, I heard a psychologist say, you guys, talking about parents, you guys could put me out of business if parents could learn to say one phrase to their children. I was wrong. Said, you people could put me out of business. But we can't. We find it so difficult to say, I don't see. We want to insist that we see. If you're too good to need grace, too good to really see things, too sure of yourselves, that puts you in the wrong category. On the other hand, the man who was blind and now healed, through the scene, gradually he comes to see and he comes to believe. I don't know if you notice the way he refers to Jesus Christ, the healer. First time he refers to Jesus, he refers to him as the one they call Jesus. Next time in verse 17, he refers to him as a prophet. Next time he refers to him in verse 33 as the man sent from God. And in the very end of the passage, he refers to Jesus as Lord. And you see the Pharisees staying where they are, no growth, only death. But this man growing, changing, evolving, developing, coming to life. And as he comes to see Jesus Christ for who he is, and as he comes to believe, he's also liberated from fear. He's not enslaved to the in crowd. His parents were self-protecting. But the man is self-forgetting. And he conducts himself with a great deal of freedom. He really turns on the Pharisees. What, do you guys want to be his disciples? He says. What kind of freedom is that for this man who's standing before the world's experts in religion? And at the same time he's getting dependent on Jesus, he's also getting more courageous and assured. Eventually, the man who's never read a book is found outwitting the experts. They just have no response for his flawless logic. And they start just, you know, they say when you're in an argument and you're losing ground, last thing you want to do is start throwing dirt. Once again, I thought that would get a laugh, but I... And this man, these Pharisees are losing ground, and the only thing they have left to do is start throwing dirt. You are born entirely in your sins. You know, there are two syllogisms. A syllogism is a logical sentence. I know some of our young people study syllogisms. There are two syllogisms at work in this whole passage. First syllogism is the one enacted by the disciples and by the Pharisees. It's built on a wrong premise, like my earlier one about Italian people. And it goes like this. If you have trouble in your life, it's because you have sin in your life. This blind man has sin in his life, has trouble in his life, therefore he must have sin in his life. But the second syllogism is put forward by the healed man. And he says to the Pharisees, you and I agree. God hears the prayers of the righteous. God evidently heard the prayers of this man and healed me. Therefore, this man is righteous. And they are trapped in their own non-logic. It's not that they couldn't see it. It's that they wouldn't see it. And in the end, This man believes. Remember what I said a couple weeks ago, believing is seeing. And he not only receives physical sight, he gets real insight into who Jesus Christ is. He gets the light of the world. He doesn't know everything, obviously. He says, all I know is I was blind, but now I see. But he's learning the meaning of life. He believes in Jesus Christ, and he has really begun to see. I want to end the sermon today in a little bit of an unusual way. I want to simulate blindness. And the way you can do that is to just close your eyes. So I'd like to ask everyone if you just close your eyes right now. I wonder now, with your eyes closed, simulated blindness, I wonder if you're free to say, Lord Jesus, I'm not sure that I see, but I know that you are the answer to my blind spots or even my total blindness. I wonder if you're free to pray, Lord, in a new and fresh way, or maybe for the first time, I come to you and I say, I trust you. I fall down and worship you. Seeing you is what I need. Lord, help me. Lord, open my eyes.